Hey everyone, welcome back to Here in Apologetics. I am so pumped that you're joining us today to have Dr. Andrew Brenner. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Hong Kong Baptist University. Today we're going to be talking on Andrew's recent book, Personal Ontology, Mystery and Its Consequences. So looking at the mind and the soul, substance dualism, all kinds of stuff. So Andrew, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Thanks for inviting me back on. I appreciate it. Looks like an interesting talk.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm really looking forward to today. We've talked before. And just to get things refreshed, Andrew, do you want to talk a little bit about like who you are, what you do, things like that?
Just brief background. I'm in the Department of Religion and Philosophy. I'm mostly on the philosophy side. So I work in philosophy, mostly metaphysics, also some other areas like philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, philosophy of religion, a little bit of ethics, a little bit of Buddhist philosophy. And then I just published this book on personal ontology. It's my first book. And I'm excited to talk about it.
So what is this book, Personal Ontology, all about?
Well, it's in metaphysics, okay? So in metaphysics, philosophers often talk about personal identity. Usually they mean personal identity over time. So what makes it the case that somebody at some time is identical with somebody at some other time? There's this related question of personal ontology, which is, what are we? Like, what sorts of things are we? Are we souls attached to bodies, like a ghost in a machine, right? Are we the soul plus the body, some sort of compound? Are we just the body? Are we the brain? Are we some particular part of the brain? Are we something else? Are we nothing at all, right? So these sorts of questions. Are the questions of personal ontology. They're related to those questions of personal identity over time, but it's not quite the same question. So this book is all about personal ontology. What are we? And I kind of argue there's some principled obstacles to our discovering the answers to these questions, or this main question of personal ontology, what are we? So I don't actually endorse an answer, because it seems to me the main options, the overall argument of the book is there's three main options. One, we don't exist at all, right? So we're nothing. So I think we can reject that. So it gives some arguments, but it's not so simple as many people think. And two, we are simple objects, meaning things without parts. So the most plausible view of that sort would be we're immaterial souls of some sort. And most people who have thought we're immaterial souls think that we're simple without parts. And the other view is we're composites of some sort. So we have parts. And for example, maybe we're human organisms and we have like hands as parts, right? Or maybe we're brains and we have neurons as parts. So I think those, once you reject the view that we don't exist, we leave the other two options, we're simple or we're composite. I think both options are implausible for more or less the same reasons, actually. So arguments against one sort of view can be parodied and transformed into arguments against the other view. So that's why I don't know what to think, right? Because I think there's sort of arguments that wreck every major view regarding personal ontology. And what's surprising is they're more or less the same arguments. And that's what I think is the main new contribution in the book. And then at the end of the book, I have a couple chapters where I thought it'd be fun to talk about personal ontology and life after death. So I discussed, like, so if we endorse some sort of agnosticism with respect to personal ontology, right, with respect to what are we, does that have any implications for, say, the possibility of life after death? Just like a fun question. So I examine in detail resurrection, reincarnation, and mind uploading. Okay, so like uploading our minds to computers or something. And I say a lot of stuff, kind of hard to summarize that last bit of the book. Although I do think, I think there's fewer implications. I think agnosticism with respect to personal ontology should not lead us towards agnosticism with respect to the possibility of life after death. Sometimes people think it does because they think, oh, you can only have life after death if we're souls, or some sort of substance dualism is true where there's a body and there's a soul and they're separate things. Some people think life after death requires that. And I don't think that's the case, actually. I think the possibility of life after death and what personal ontology we endorse, those come apart more than people generally realize. So maybe that's one theme of the last part of the book. So that's just a brief overview of what I talk about over the course of that book.
So Andrew, I'm wondering then, like, First off, like just this idea of like the sense of the self, like as you were talking in the beginning, Andrew, you talked about like I was thinking about even myself, like my existence, like in this moment as recording this podcast. Well, I'd like to say the same me that exists now existed yesterday with everything that I was doing, and the same me existed 5 years ago and 10 years ago. And when I was a little kid, it's the same me as it is right now. What is this idea of self and like the idea that like we are the same person over time, or maybe we aren't the same person over time? Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah. Well, this is connected in a couple different ways with the discussion in my book. I'll give like two examples, right? So I think it's possible I existed 5 minutes ago and yesterday and 5 years ago and so on. But some people argue, say, if I was an immaterial soul, for example, then I couldn't know that. I couldn't know that I was the same soul in this body that was here 5 minutes ago. Or I couldn't know that if I'm talking to you over the course of 5 minutes, I couldn't know that your body's not being occupied by different souls over the course of 5 minutes. And that's supposed to be an argument against the view that we're souls, right? Because it's supposed to be ridiculous. Like, of course I can know I'm talking to the same guy. I think that argument fails. And I can say why if you want, but before I forget, I want to say the other way in which this question of that you sort of raised might connect with personal ontology, which is that actually one of the prominent arguments against our existence, one of the prominent arguments for the view that we don't exist, appeals to this sort of consideration, which is that if I exist, surely I persist over time, right? Like if I exist, surely I existed 10 years ago. And hopefully I'll exist 10 years from now. But the argument goes, if you look carefully at the mind and the body, nothing persists that long, right? There's nothing right here that was here 10 years ago, right? So I can't have existed 10 years ago. But then the conclusion is supposed to be I don't exist at all, because if I do exist, surely I existed 10 years ago. And this sort of argument actually goes back to the Buddha himself. In our earliest recorded records of the teachings of the Buddha, he gives this argument a bunch of times. This not in those exact words. This sort of argument a bunch of times. And I also address that argument in the book. I say, that argument is not a good argument. And I can elaborate on either of those points more if you want, but reflecting on this question, can I really know when this, like Andrew here is the same guy who was there 10 years ago? Can I really know that? Reflecting on that question, sometimes people think it has these surprising implications for what we think about personal ontology. Either it shows that, oh, I can't possibly be a soul, or it shows I don't even exist, right?
So what do you think, Andrew? Like, do we have a self that exists like apart from like our physical existence that is persisting over time? Like, is the case that like, okay, maybe like biologically, like everything that existed that I think of me doesn't exist 10 years ago, but maybe, it's just, or what I'm trying to say is like maybe over the past 10 years, like I'm biologically like completely different. Like all my molecules and cells and whatnot are replaced. But maybe my soul or something still exists. Like, what do you think? Like, is there a self that exists apart from our physical existence?
So I think the term self, I think the best way to use it, it's used in a ton of different ways in philosophy and like psychology and related fields. And it can get really confusing. When I use the word self, I just mean me. So one way to interpret your question is, did I exist 10 years ago? And if so, does that require that I have some sort of non-physical component that existed 10 years ago and that exists now? So the first question, yeah, I did exist 10 years ago. It would be really implausible that I was replaced, that there was that guy back there 10 years ago and they're not me, right? Because then at some point they have to be swapped with somebody else. And why would that happen, right? So like that's like the basic objection. It's just there's no reason to think that swap happened. There is this concern though. Well, look, if you look at my mind and my body, they're constantly changing. Like I used to have all this hair up here and now there's this blinding light off the top of my head because there's no more hair there, right? It's distracting you the whole video. So if I existed 10 years ago, how could that be if my mind and my body are constantly changing? I think the answer to that question does not require a non-physical component. There could be a non-physical component, but I think it doesn't require it. So imagine that I'm a soul, like an immaterial soul, Now, as I said, that view might be true. I'm not rejecting that view. It might be true. On that case, it's not hard to see how I existed 10 years ago, despite the fact that I lost hair and all the parts of my body have changed or whatever. That's not a mystery, right? But on the other hand, suppose I'm not an immaterial soul. Suppose I'm wholly physical. So I'm a physical object with only physical parts, like I'm a body or something like that. But I think even then, I could still exist even if all my parts change, right? Why not, right? So like I would be a composite object. I'm composed of parts, but I don't have to be composed of these exact parts, right? I could swap parts, right? And technically, I've read, I mean, some of our parts haven't swapped, like the enamel in my teeth have apparently been there forever. Parts of my eye have always been there. Parts of my brain have always been there. But ignore that, even supposing all of the parts of my body have been swapped over time. I don't think, I still think I could persist over time, right? Even if I'm a wholly physical object, because like I don't require those parts, right? Just like I could lose a fingernail and I still exist, I could lose lots of other parts and still exist. I don't see why, in principle, that couldn't work. That's why I think this sort of persistence over time, I think it's works either way, whether we are wholly physical objects with only physical parts, or whether we are non-physical or have some sort of non-physical part like a soul. Either way, it's compatible with our
So you,
persistence over even radical changes. Yeah.
so it's like you're cool, like either way, like okay, maybe there is like this physical self, and it's like, but we and we don't need like some sort of like dualism or idealism, like even like a physical, like even like a physicalist view, you could say, okay, like cool, like there still is a self that persists over time, regardless of whether physicalism is true or obviously if idealism or dualism or something like that is true, then you could see that as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And like one motivation for that would just be, look, it's a lot simpler to think there's one guy here the whole time, right? Suppose like if you swap enough of my parts, suddenly a new guy shows up. I cease to exist and I'm replaced by somebody else who looks just like me. Well, one, why would that happen, right? That just seems like really weird, right? And like this sort of this weirdly complex behavior, like how often does that happen? Like every 5 minutes, every 5 years, like, right? You're gonna need some like new law of nature or something that's like, oh, when if you swap this many parts, that guy's gone and they're replaced by somebody else. I just like, why would that happen? It seems a lot simpler to say it's the same guy that persists over all those changes. But in addition, there's these questions like, what parts matter, right? So if I lose my hair, I still exist. What parts do I cease? If I lose those, I cease to exist, right? It just doesn't seem like a non-arbitrary answer to that question, right? Like, oh, if you lose this one little molecule right here, that's the hair that broke the camel's back or whatever. Suddenly you cease to exist. But and then you're replaced by somebody who looks just like you. So that just seems kind of weird to me. Like I just think it's a lot simpler to say, even if I'm a wholly physical object, I could persist over those sorts of changes. Which is not to say I am a wholly physical object. The whole point of my book is I don't know. I don't know what to say about that.
I love that, and I just googled it to check. It's the straw that broke the camel's back, at least according
Oh
to
yeah, I couldn't
Wikipedia. Is
remember at first.
that as I googled
I was
it?
like
So,
pausing because I couldn't. Yeah, sorry.
well, no, I'm in the same way. I'm like, thank goodness for Google because I would have kind of forgot that as well. So, Andrew, you spend a lot of time in your book talking about like substance dualism. I'd love to like sketch on that briefly before we get into like I'd love to talk about some of these different ideas about like resurrection and reincarnation or digital uploading. Andrew, what are some of the arguments against substance dualism? What are the arguments for substance dualism? I know you wrote a lot about this, and I'm asking you to summarize it very briefly, but like, what do you got here?
So one argument for substance dualism, actually, I kind of just mentioned, right? Which is that, or I implied it, which is that you need substance dualism for to account for the fact that we persist over various changes, right? Like our various body parts change, but we continue to exist. And allegedly, you need substance dualism to make that possible. You need an immaterial soul to make that possible. So that's actually one argument for substance dualism. I've kind of indicated why I don't like that argument. But so maybe I'll turn to some arguments against substance dualism. So by substance dualism, I haven't actually defined it. I just mean we're immaterial souls, or we're made up of soul and body. So it's usually what people mean by substance dualism. And let me see. I discuss a few arguments against substance dualism in the book. And I argue that they all fail, in part because they can all be parodied, right? meaning you can pretty easily modify the argument to turn it around and make it an argument against R being physical composite objects like organisms or brains, right? It's kind of like how, well, on this channel, you know, like the Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God, right? So God has to exist because God's like the greatest conceivable being. Imagine God exists only in my mind because I'm thinking about God that doesn't exist in reality. Well, then I could think of a greater being, one that exists in my mind and in reality. So God has to exist because otherwise he'd be the greatest conceivable being. And yet I can conceive of a greater being who exists in my mind and reality. So there's lots of other ontological arguments, and a common objection is they can be parodied, right? So a parody to this ontological argument goes back to the same time period as Anselm from another monk who argued, oh, this using the same set of argument, you could establish that a perfect island exists, right? It has to exist in reality because otherwise you could think of a better island, one that exists in my mind and in reality, right? So that's how parodies work, right? They don't necessarily show what's wrong with the original argument. They just show something has to be wrong with the original argument, because otherwise you'll have to accept, like if you accept the original argument, you'll also have to accept this other parody argument, which is clearly a bad argument. Right? Nobody wants to use an ontological argument for the existence of a perfect island. So I use that same sort of strategy, right? I consider arguments for substance dualism, against substance dualism, and I parody them. And I kind of swap them around. All right, so here's like one example. Here's an argument against substance dualism. And it's from, I'm thinking of one that's simple to state. Yeah, so here's a very common argument against substance dualism. So we know that our various mental states are correlated in systematic ways with what goes on in our brain, right? So so the fact that I'm awake and conscious right now is associated with certain brain activity. If I was sleeping and totally unconscious or sleeping in a dream, I'd have different brain activity, right? Or if you if I take hallucinogenic drugs, that will cause certain changes in what's going on in my brain, which will have reliably can be expected to cause certain changes in my mental states, right? Maybe I hallucinate. So we know there's these systematic correlations between what happens in the mind and what happens in the brain. And allegedly, this is a big problem for substance dualism. It's usually not spelled out what the problem actually is, right? Because like substance dualists know about these systematic correlations, right? It's not a surprise, right? They know about this stuff. They've known about this stuff for literally thousands of years, right? Like you bop somebody on the head, and they're going to feel pain or go unconscious. You hit somebody in the head hard enough. Like people have known that forever. So what is the problem for substance dualism? Usually it's not spelled out. I think we could spell it out like this. These systematic correlations between what happens in the brain and what happens in the mind, they're not totally incompatible with substance dualism, right? They're not flatly incompatible, but they're not predicted by substance dualism. Like as far as substance dualism is concerned, maybe my mental states are systematically correlated with my brain states. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're systematically correlated to something else. Or maybe they're not systematically correlated with anything in the physical world, right? That's how, like if there's disembodied spirits, that's presumably how it is for them. Right? So substance dualism is compatible with the systematic mind-brain correlations, but it doesn't predict it. And that's why maybe it's some weak evidence against substance dualism, because this there's an alternative view that allegedly does predict it. So if I just am my brain, or I just am my body, which has the brain as a part, then allegedly it's not surprising that what goes on in my mind is so closely correlated with what's going on in my brain, right? Because I am my brain, or I am my body, which has the brain as a part. So I think that's the best way of making sense of the objection to substance dualism. That there's these mind-brain correlations, and they're not flatly inconsistent with substance dualism, but maybe they're like a little surprising, right? There's no particular reason to expect them if I'm an immaterial soul, right? Here's the parody, right? I think this exact, literally almost pretty much the exact same problem affects the alternative view. So assume that I'm a composite physical object, like my body, or even like my brain. There's some physical events happening in my brain, some neurons firing, some subatomic particles that make up those neurons. They're doing stuff, whatever's involved in this physical brain activity that's happening right now. But let's talk on the level of subatomic particles. Well, I'm not a subatomic particle on this view, right? I'm a thing composed of subatomic particles. So you could ask, well, why is it the case that the mental states I have are so systematically correlated with what's happening with these other objects, these subatomic particles that aren't me, right? So notice it's exactly the same sort of question we asked the substance dualist. Why is it the case that what happens in my soul, this immaterial object, is so systematically correlated with what's happening in these other objects, these neurons in this brain? Okay. We're asking the exact same sort of question. If I am a brain, or if I'm an organism or whatever, why is it the case that my mental states are so systematically correlated with what's happening with these subatomic particles in my brain? Okay. And I could say the systematic correlation is not flatly inconsistent with me being a brain or an organism, but it's not predicted by my being a brain or an organism, right? So suppose that I'm a brain. It doesn't follow just from that my mental states are systematically correlated with what's going on with the subatomic particles in my brain, okay? It may very well be that my mental states are systematically correlated with what goes on in my computer or what goes on in your brain or some other object, right? The mere fact that I'm a brain or an organism or whatever does not entail all by itself that my mental states are determined by what's going on in the subatomic particles in my brain. That's my point, right? And I think there is a story to tell about why what happens to the subatomic particles causes me to have certain mental states. You're gonna need like psychophysical laws linking physical states, particles or whatever with mental states. But the substance dualists can say the exact same thing. They'll just say, hey, I also have psychophysical laws that link what's happening in the neurons in my brain and my mental states, okay? Now, I was trying to pick a simpler argument, but actually that turned out, now that I actually went through every step, it sounded a little more complicated than I thought it would. Maybe if I have time, maybe I can give one simpler example, okay? So remember earlier I said, some people think if I'm an immaterial soul, how can you be sure the same guy you're talking to now is the guy you were talking to 5 minutes ago, right? Because I'm just a soul, and like I'm a ghost in a machine, ghost in a shell. I'm just a soul occupying this body, right? For all you know, it could be a different soul from the one you were talking to 5 minutes ago. How do you know? There's no way to know. And allegedly, that's a problem for substance dualism. Well, I think literally like the exact same problem comes up if I'm a brain or an organism, okay? Let's say I'm an organism. I have all these physical parts. How do you know these parts compose the same organism they composed 5 minutes ago, right? How do you know they still compose any organism? Maybe it's just the parts and they no longer compose an organism. So for all you know, the parts of my body composed some organism 5 minutes ago and you were talking to them, and then that organism was swapped. And now they compose a different organism, okay? How can you know, right? So allegedly, If it's problematic for the substance dualist, how do you know the person you're talking to now is the same person you were talking to 5 minutes ago? If that's a problem for substance dualism, it seems like the exact same problem comes up if I'm a body or a brain or some other composite physical object. It seems to me like literally pretty much the exact same problem. So that's a simpler example of how this common argument against substance dualism, I think, can be flipped around and parodied pretty easily and turned into an argument against the opposite view, that I'm a physical object of some sort, like a body or a brain. So it's just a couple examples of the sort of thing I do here in this book.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. That's really helpful. What I'd love to do in like this last part of the interview here is talk about these different parts of how, I don't know if you want to say like soul or mind, what words would you use in this last section about talking about the possible different states?
It's probably less ambiguous if I use the word soul to mean soul, and I probably shouldn't use the word mind at all because it's kind of ambiguous. So usually when I just use the word mind, I just mean I'm just talking about my mental life, right? That doesn't necessarily imply that there's this thing, a mind, that's separate from my body or anything like that. So maybe we should actually probably avoid the word mind if we can help it, because it can be misleading.
Let's talk about how like the soul relates to these different states, these different possible states after death. Because you talked about three different ones in the book. So the first one is resurrection. Like, how do you think the soul could relate to the idea of like resurrection?
So sometimes, the standard, a standard view of the afterlife in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is after death, we'll be dead for a while, and then we'll be resurrected. And that's the afterlife, or the life after the afterlife, or something like that, resurrection. So we'll have new bodies, or maybe the same body, like we'll have bodies, right? We'll come back to life, just like Jesus, right? That's the idea. And sometimes it's claimed, this view can't possibly be right unless substance dualism is right, unless we're immaterial souls of some sort. Because look, when I die, my body decays, it's scattered to the winds, right? Turns into dust. How could you bring that back? How could you bring this very body back? Like, if I am a body, for example, how could you bring me back? Because that would require recreating this body, even though it's turned to dust, right? And allegedly you can't do that. But if I'm a soul, it's pretty easy to see how you could bring me back, right? Just create a body that looks like this one and pop the soul into it, right? That's why resurrection is supposed to be easy. And I just argue, I feel like resurrection could work out either way. I don't really see it's a problem if we're immaterial souls or physical objects like bodies or organisms or brains. I think either way, resurrection could make sense. I don't see why not. That mainly consists of just like addressing arguments for the other view, right? Let's say you can't bring back a body or a brain or whatever after it's decayed. And I just feel like those arguments just don't carry any weight to me. I could give an example if you want, but I don't know where I'm mindful of the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that like even like we have time, like thinking about like the physical, like it seems like if we have like a substance dualism or idealism, something like that is true, resurrection just seems very straightforward. And even like under like say like physicalism is true, and our soul is like a part of like an emergent like physical process or something along those lines. It just seems to me like, okay, well, we have an infinite God, like why isn't there a way that self could continue, that soul could continue? I don't know.
Yeah,
that's just my feel.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a passage in the Quran that makes exactly that point. It's like, look, God made me the first time. Like, who are you to say God couldn't do it again, right? So like, decay after death, this is God we're talking about, right? He can do whatever he wants. So if he wants to recreate the same body, what's stopping him, right? There's got to be some way God can pull it off. And I think that sounds plausible to me. This is an omnipotent God we're talking about. Like, what's the problem? I feel like worst case scenario. I don't endorse this view, but the philosopher Peter Van Inwagen, he actually converted to Christianity as an adult. But before he converted to Christianity, he addressed this question. If I'm a physical object, could I be resurrected after death? And he argued the only way he could think for that to work is if, like, when I die, God replaces my body with a fake that keeps the original for safekeeping somewhere and then brings that body back. And like, it sounds a little silly. I think that like God doesn't need to resort to that. But worst case scenario, like God could do that, right? I don't see why not. God really could if that's like really the only way to resurrect me. So I feel like worst case scenario, that's like the backup plan, even if nothing else works.
So what about then, Andrew, like this idea of like reincarnation? How does this relate then to like the soul and after death? Like, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, same thing. So, or I say some similar stuff. So some people generally assume if reincarnation was real, it would require substance dualism. And it's easy to see how it works. I'm in this body. I'm a soul. I'm not the body. I'm a non-physical object, the soul. And then I die and then I go to a new body. In like a little baby or whatever, and I have a new life, and that's reincarnation. So it's easy to see how that would work if substance dualism were true, if I was an immaterial soul. But I think even if I'm a physical object, let's say I'm a body, I feel like it could still work, right? So if I'm a body, I'm composed of these physical parts, right? And reincarnation could just be in the next life, I'm composed of some new parts, right? some different parts, but it's still me, right? They still compose me. I just don't see any like obvious barrier to that happening. I do think there's some other concerns about reincarnation. But I don't think that concern is a real issue. And in fact, actually, so one conclusion here, which I think is at least a little surprising, one conclusion I draw is, so there's all this alleged evidence for reincarnation, right? Like memories of past lives, like languages people allegedly learned in past lives, or if you died by drowning, then when you're a two-year-old, you're suddenly afraid of water. Or there's an alleged case where this little 2 or 3 year old child wanted to kill this guy. Like, I need to kill that man. He murdered me, right? And or like wounds on your body where you got stabbed, allegedly, like birthmarks. So there's all these like alleged evidence for reincarnation. Most of them involve like mental states that have allegedly passed from one life to the next, like memories of a previous life, or I hate that guy, or knowledge of languages you couldn't have learned in this life, right? So many people think if we did have good, well authenticated evidence of that sort, like cases where people really did seem to remember past lives in verifiable ways that where they couldn't have possibly have learned this information in their current life, right? Many people think if we had that sort of evidence, it would be good evidence for substance dualism. I don't even think that's true, because for kind of an obvious reason, when you think about it, like even on substance dualism, like memories are encoded in the body and the brain, right? Memories are not encoded in the soul, right? We know that's pretty much how it works. I don't know all the scientific details, right? But even if I'm an immaterial soul, like memories don't live in the soul. Memories live in my brain, right? It's like if you damage the brain enough, you can remove a lot of my memories, right? That would be surprising if memories are stored somewhere else other than the brain. So I think if if you move a soul from one life to the next in reincarnation, that by itself would have no tendency at all to carry memories or other psychological states from one life to the next, for that very obvious reason that the psychological states are encoded in the body and the brain, not in the soul. So I think even if we did have these cases where we had really good evidence that people had memories or whatever from previous lives, I don't think that would actually be evidence for reincarnation at all, right? Because like, how would it be, right? It's not evidence that a soul has moved from one life to the next, because memories aren't encoded in the soul. It wouldn't be an argument that a body or a brain has moved from one life to the next. Like it was composed of some parts in a previous life and it's composed of different parts now, because again, memories are not encoded in the body or the brain. They're technically encoded in the parts of the body, in the parts of the brain, right? In the way neurons are connected to each other or whatever. So that's like a somewhat surprising conclusion I think I reach in that section, which is even if we have these sorts of well-authenticated cases of like memories from a previous life, for example, that would be weird. That would be very weird, right? We'd want to look for some explanation for that. Like, how could that happen? But I don't think it would actually provide any evidence, surprisingly, for reincarnation, which I find that's a little surprising, right? I'm not saying it wouldn't be enough evidence to convince us of reincarnation. I'm saying it would be literally no evidence for reincarnation, because that's just not how memories work, right? So that's one kind of interesting conclusion I argue for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting, Andrew. What about the idea of like digital uploading? Like, what is digital uploading, and how does our soul relate to our possible like digital uploading after death?
So this is like a really complicated question. Mind uploading. Could I move into a computer? Could I thwart death by like uploading myself to my laptop or whatever? How would that work? Usually the idea is you get a sufficiently, it's usually some strategy involving like you make a sufficiently detailed copy of me or of my brain or of my psychological states in a computer, and you hope for the best, you hope it's me, right? One way to do that is whole brain emulation. You try to emulate my whole brain in a computer and you hope it's me, right? One problem there is as far as we know, or with current and foreseeable technology, the only way to do that, to really get a very detailed map of the brain, is to like slice it a little bit at a time and scan each slice, right? And like, that's gonna kill me, right? So like, for this to work, I have to already be dead, right? Which if I'm trying to thwart death, that's fine, right? I guess like if I'm already dead. It's just, if I'm already dead, the brain might be broken, it might be messed up, right? So anyway, there's all sorts of practical difficulties. That's all I'm saying. There's all sorts of practical difficulties here. But let's say you could create, like, say, a whole brain emulation in a computer of my brain. It's a perfect emulation of my brain. It maps, like, all the activities of all the neurons and whatever. Would that carry personal identity? Would I have somehow been moved to the computer? And again, some people seem to think this sort of thing would this sort of possibility would require substance dualism as well. Some people think that. They say, like, if I'm a brain or a body or an organism, or like, you haven't moved any physical objects into a computer, right? You've just like created a duplicate. You've just scanned some information and moved the information into the computer. You haven't moved a physical object into the computer. So if I've been moved into the computer, I must not be a physical object, right? Because you haven't moved a physical object into the computer. So for that sort of reason, some people think the sort of mind uploading, if it did preserve personal identity, it would require that I'm an immaterial soul. I don't think that's quite right. But I'm less confident here because... So the book is about personal ontology, but it's about the personal ontology of you and me. Flesh and blood people, what are we, right? There's this very interesting separate question, which isn't addressed too much, which is the personal ontology of uploaded minds or simulated minds more generally. And this is relevant if we create an AI that we start to suspect could be like conscious or something like that. You could ask this question, well, what is that AI? Like, what is it? And I think it's just like extremely unclear what to say here. Right. There's like a few different options and like none of them seem very good. And in particular, none of them seem like they would be very helpful for mind uploading in practice. So, for example, let's say I am an immaterial mind. Like I say, I am an immaterial soul housed in this body. And we want me to be housed in a computer or like a robot body or something like that. That would be mind uploading. And the way we do it is we scan my brain and we try to create a perfect replica of my perfect simulation of my brain in a computer. And then you're just gonna ask, like, why would that move my soul? Like, why would it? Like, so like my soul realizes, oh, a perfect duplicate has been made in like Silicon Valley, thousands of miles away of my brain. Why would that like somehow snatch the soul from way over here and move it over there? Like, there's just like no particular reason to think that would happen. And there's other possibilities that also aren't super amenable to mind uploading. Well, I'll give like one example, which I think is a little under discussed, like the details of it. You could say, well, I'm not a soul. Let's say I was mind uploaded into a computer. I'm not a soul then. And I'm not a computer either. And I'm not like a network of computers or particular parts of computers. Maybe I'm just a simulation. And that's what you should say. I'm just like this new category of object, simulation. It's not a computer. It's not a physical part of a computer. It's not a network of computers. It's not an immaterial soul. It's like this new category of objects, a simulation. I think the problem there is you get into these surprisingly difficult metaphysical questions regarding simulation. It's like, what is it for something to be a simulation of something else? I think there's no objective answer to that question. When is something a simulation of something else? Like, let's say you want to simulate a battle. You could do that using pixels on a computer screen. You could create like a detailed visual simulation of the battle. You could do that with little toys on a table, right? That could simulate the battle. Or you could have like little rocks or raisins on the ground. That could simulate the battle, right? What makes each of those count as a simulation of the battle is just like the way we approach it. You could say, oh yeah, those raisins, those are soldiers. Right, those pixels, those are soldiers, whatever. Right, so it's a matter of the way we think about the way things are set up. In other words, a philosopher might say there's an element of response dependence involved here, or anti-realism involved, in what makes something a simulation of something else. But I don't think personal identity would be like that, right? Personal identity, either I'm there or I'm not, right? You shouldn't say whether mind uploading has worked and it's preserved my personal identity and I moved into a computer. That shouldn't depend on whether people think the simulation is a simulation of me. There shouldn't be any element of response dependence there or anti-realism. It should be an objective matter. Either I'm there or I'm not, right? Either I exist or I don't. But if I'm supposed to be a simulation in that situation, well, I think simulations, there's this inescapable element of anti-realism, response dependence. Just like with the example of the battle, what makes something a simulation of a battle depends on how we view the setup. And that's like a Cliff Notes version of some stuff I say about the ontology of simulated persons. It gets surprisingly technical and difficult and complicated, but I think these are actually kind of underexplored questions, the personal ontology of uploaded persons or simulated persons more generally, or virtual persons more generally. And I think more philosophers need to work on this, especially as we get like these AIs that are going to start wondering, is there somebody in there, right? Is there a ghost in the machine or whatever? We're going to start having to address the ontology of these things. Like, what are they, if anything? So that's just a little bit of what I say about that issue. I guess on mind uploading, it's a lot more tentative what I say, and I draw less firm conclusions. It just seems like kind of a conceptual mess. It's like kind of unclear what to say about any of this stuff. It gets kind of complicated.
Yeah, it definitely sounds that way, Andrew. And thank you. I think you did a really good job of briefly sketching out like what mind uploading, not digital uploading, is. So thank you for that. Andrew, is there anything like you want to say here to like wrap up before we start to close up here?
If you're interested in the book, you know, academic books are like super expensive often when they're first published. So the main audience is academic libraries. So if anybody is listening and they're interested in checking out the book, but you're not a millionaire or whatever, just email me and I'll email you a copy of the book. So that's what I want to say.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you and everything you're doing. I'll leave a link down below to the book. And yeah, thank you everyone for listening to Heater Projects. We appreciate you and your time. And if you value Heater Projects, be sure to like, subscribe, all that fun stuff. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/heaterapologetics. But Andrew, as always, I really enjoyed talking with you. I feel like we got deep, but there was a lot of stuff that like I think is accessible for people to hear and understand. So thank you so much for communicating so clearly.
Thanks for having me on. It's great. Anytime.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. I hope you have a good one and God bless. We'll catch you next time.